from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, the realization that everyday devices like DVRs and baby monitors were used to take down parts of the internet on Friday has consumers wondering about the security of their web-connected devices. We look at why cybersecurity experts are calling Friday's attack just the beginning. Then at 9:30, the American Academy of Pediatrics has relaxed its guidelines on screen time for kids. We talk with the lead author of the new recommendations and take your questions about the impact of screens on children. That's all next on Forum. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Federal agencies are still trying to figure out who was behind the massive cyber attack Friday that took out major websites for hours, including Twitter, Spotify, and the New York Times. Cybersecurity experts say the attack exposed a new level of internet vulnerability by using household smart devices like cameras, microwaves, thermostats, and light bulbs. And they say it's a wake-up call for consumers of web-connected devices that are exploding in popularity but often lack basic security features. In this opening half-hour forum, we look at why security experts say more attacks could be coming and what we should do now to protect ourselves. And we're joined this half-hour by cybersecurity expert Jeremiah Grossman. He's chief of security strategy at Sentinel One, the computer security service. Good morning, Jeremiah Grossman.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for joining us. And we're also joined by Alina Selyuk. She is host of NPR's All Tech Considered blog. Good morning, Alina Selyuk.
Good morning.
So, Alina, catch us up if you would. As I mentioned in the intro, it's still unclear who did this. Where is that at in terms of the investigation?
We still do not know who did this. We know that the Department of Homeland Security is involved. The FBI was involved in the investigation as well. And, of course, the company that was at the center of it all, it's called Dyn. That company is still investigating, and a few of its partners are. They're all working together trying to see what the goal of this attack was and who was behind it. But what we do know is some of the elements of how it was carried out. And to your point earlier, it was carried out through co-opting of a bunch of internet-connected devices, things rather than computers, and then overwhelming Dyn's servers and data centers. And that's how we saw this attack spread across a variety of websites rather than one, which is what you would kind of typically habitually see, that every once in a while a website goes down and you know it's what's called a DDoS attack, a distributed denial of service attack.
Right. And before we get into more of the specifics of the attack, I just want to make clear, we don't know who did it, even though hacker groups like Anonymous and New World Hacker said they were responsible for it.
No, we still don't know. They haven't disclosed. And at one point, Dyn was asked whether this was a state-sponsored attack, which is, of course, kind of top of the mind for folks worried about election results upcoming. There are no kind of pieces of evidence that have been suggested to really pin this on one group or the other.
And Jeremiah Grossman, the fact, though, is that regardless of who actually did it, one of the things that's notable about this particular attack is that the code, I guess, that was used to carry it out is available theoretically. What does that mean?
So the program, the source code of the program that was used to co-opt these devices, these Internet of Things devices, was released maybe a week to 10 days ago for anybody to use and modify and improve upon. And I think that was done on purpose because it makes attribution harder, because now there could be one or more groups using this software to conduct denial of service attacks that are nearly identical.
Yeah, and as Alina Selyuk was saying, the FBI says at this point there seems to be no evidence that the groups that said they did this, in part one said that they did it because they were retaliating for Ecuador cutting off the internet access of Julian Assange, that there's no evidence that they actually carried it out at this point. And Alina Selyuk also talked a little bit about how the attack was carried out. Can you explain what Dyne does and what specifically happened to that company?
Sure. Dyne DNS is a third-party DNS provider. You have to think of DNS on the internet kind of like the internet's phone book. When you assign a domain name like www.website.com to an IP address, how you connect computers together. So before you can connect to a website, you need this very central service called DNS. And it's integral to the way that how the internet works. And it's so integral that a lot of companies out there use third-party service providers for scale to make sure they operate stably and quickly. So when you knock out a provider like Dyne DNS, ideally you want to switch over and have a fail-safe, but in this case it didn't work that well. And so when Dyne DNS went away, no one could connect easily or at all.
And the significance, of course, is that this was the first large-scale attack that used Internet of Things devices. Can you talk about why this was so unprecedented?
It's something that the security industry has been warning that was going to come for a while, because while normal people will look at a IP-connected camera, a baby monitor, even an HVAC system as a device that they buy from the store, they are really just mini computers. They're just not as powerful or sophisticated as a normal desktop PC. So you can hack into them much in the same way as any computer or server around the world. And so what happens here is the bad guys will hack into these IoT devices, co-opt them, and control them as a single entity, hence the term botnet. And when you flood a lot of traffic towards one provider, you can make it go offline.
And folks tend to have way more of these types of devices than, say, your traditional computer or something that would have been used to, could have been basically commandeered to carry out this type of attack?
Yeah, in the average household, you might have a number of these devices. They could be, coffee pots, could be your refrigerator, your microwave, and there's many, many millions, tens of millions already in circulation. And the statistics will say we think about 20 billion or more of these devices will be arriving, in the general households or businesses in the next 5 years. So it's not just the number of devices; it's the access to bandwidth they have. Imagine for a moment, in the case of this particular botnet, they had 500,000 of them at their disposal, meaning 500,000 different networks that they can attack somebody with.
And Alina Sayu, can you explain for us why these types of devices are growing in popularity? What are some of the features that they allow folks to do?
Well, this is the promise of the 21st century. You're going to be surrounded by all of these quote-unquote smart devices that you can interact with. People find it, well, first, it's kind of fun and exciting, but second, it is this kind of idea of convenience that is perpetuated by internet connectivity. Suddenly, you can have this dream of like waking up in the morning and have your coffee pot be smart enough to know that your calendar says your work starts at 9, therefore it needs to prepare coffee half an hour in advance, that sort of thing. I mean, we're buying devices that you can talk with, that you can interact in a more human way, that will turn on your lights and connect to your thermostat. You can preset temperature from your phone when you're away, so you can control the temperature at your house and maybe try to save a little money. All of these different elements, they go from really small scale to having those baby monitors that you can connect and monitor when you're away, to self-driving cars that are connected to the internet, which allows them to interact with each other and try to avoid collisions. Those are growing in popularity. And the wireless carriers are hoping and betting that this will actually keep growing, because they're building out in even faster networks for the next generation. So this is sort of the new wave of how we interact with technology and expect technology to understand us.
And hence why Jeremiah Grossman is saying the projections are like 20 billion of these devices. We're talking with Alina Selyukh. She's host of NPR's All Tech Considered blog, and Jeremiah Grossman, chief of security strategy at Sentinel One. And we'd like to open the phone lines for your questions about what happened during the attack, what you can do to protect your web-connected devices. The number to call for this half-hour segment is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org or post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, or on our website, kqed.org/forum. So Jeremiah Grossman, I just want to ask you a few basic questions about what happened to the folks who owned these devices when the attack was being carried out. So if, you know, a hacker or a hacktivist group or even a state, since the theories are also out there about who may have carried out this particular attack, were they able to gain access not just to the device, but to other devices on the network that that device may have been on, like a Wi-Fi network at a home?
That's a good question. When you hack into these devices, there's no evidence right now that they've used their foothold on these devices in the home network to branch out to attack other things, whether it's on the same home user's network or other. But it is very possible that they could have done so. They just maybe just didn't. And maybe that could come later. So again, there's 500,000 of these devices out there, and they have access to the microwave next to it, the coffee pot, your, you know, all these sorts of devices on the network. They're all right there within physical proximity.
And if they broke into like a baby monitor, a video baby monitor, were they likely able to see the video because they accessed the password?
I think they might have been able to if they tried. But again, no evidence in this particular instance that they have done so or done so yet. Maybe that can come later. It is a possibility. It's a possibility. And that goes to the point of motive. Whoever this is, what are their motives and what are they likely to do? I personally don't think it was nation state sponsored. Might have been either cyber criminal related, those that are tooling up and trying to make money for later on attacks, or as an experimentation where you have hacktivists and trying to get out a political message. But I think right now we're just seeing the experimentation of what's later to come.
And that's why you think other attacks could be imminent.
Absolutely, because it's the first of its kind. So when you look at the history of computer security, we're used to dealing with incidents such as this where there's an unprecedented type of event, and we can kind of play it forward on what the bad guys are likely to do next. So this right here shows us it's the very first IoT-based botnet using one particular type of device. The next generations will be much bigger, using many more devices, and they're going to have a lot more power at their disposal. They're not going to stop here.
And Alina Salyuk, why are Internet of Things manufacturers not required to do more in terms of a base level of security for these devices?
On a very simple level, that is just the newness of all of this. This is a relatively new field, a relatively new type of device. It's fair to say that they have been urged to increase the security for quite a while by cybersecurity experts who have been warning that Internet of Things devices are very vulnerable to attacks and have been forewarning that this kind of attack could happen. But there hasn't been quite the amount of pressure that I expect will happen now that we've seen very vividly what an IoT-based distributed denial of service attack could look like. You have seen already the Department of Homeland Security is saying that they're working closely with communication service providers to develop quote-unquote strategic principles for securing internet-connected devices. And that is typically the first step and a very, very critical step to improving security of devices, is to have folks who make them kind of come around the same table and say, these are the things that we're going to do now. These are the things that we're going to demand from our partners, which is a far stronger pressure to improve security than trying to set regulations, which might be like 2-3 years down the road.
Well, Bruce writes, please explain if and how our electronic vote counting system may be vulnerable to cyber attack, particularly in states that don't use a paper trail. Jeremiah Grossman, this is something you're concerned about Election Day disruptions.
A little bit. Not related to this latest botnet attack. If you're going to attack an election, you know, with using cyber, if you want to use that vernacular, it's probably not going to be with an denial of service attack. You would ideally focus more on very particular counties and swing state regions where you might be able to sway the election 1-2%. There's not a whole lot of evidence that this has transpired yet, but it's something that's very much on the minds of computer security professionals, and one we're looking at these electronic devices and, you know, we don't trust them. And that's the point. You can disrupt an election, not necessarily electronically, but by disrupting the trust that people have in the system, because there isn't a whole lot of transparency going on.
Well, let's go to Guillermo in San Leandro. Hi, Guillermo.
Hi. Yes, my question is, I have been here before, that hackers can take your identity or your computer number or your network ID, which is on a DNA, I believe, something like that, and they can use your computer to commit crimes such as stealing people's identity or commit any other crimes to any other community members. So the question is how you prevent that and what you have to do to prove to the authorities that your computer was hacked and it was an issue that you were not aware of.
Guillermo, thanks. Jeremiah Grossman?
Sure. That's actually a really good question and one that does relate to the central story here. Hackers have been known to co-opt people's devices to hack into them, whether they're their computers, usually their computers, and commit a cybercrime to attack another computer, hack another person, hack a business. And when they investigate the crime, it'll go back to somebody who really didn't, a co-opted or a malware-infected computer. And it looks like, for all intents and purposes, that that person committed the crime. So there's one thing that the home user could do is make sure that their machine is secure, you know, make sure they have good, strong passwords, different per website, that they keep their machine up to date so they don't get malware, the business that Sentinel One is in. But there is also the aspect that law enforcement must use more than an IP address in order to prosecute someone or say that, you know, or accuse somebody of a crime. IP addresses are not the end-all be-all for indicating of who committed a cybercrime.
Well, Guillermo, thanks so much for the question. Another listener writes, were these Internet of Things directly connected to the Internet, or were they behind a firewall? Most Internet companies like AT&T give you a modem router that has a firewall. Did these hackers easily bypass these firewalls, and what could a consumer do to fix their firewall? Jeremiah,
that's another great
question.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Another great question. These devices were connected directly to the Internet. They weren't behind the NATed firewall, to use the technical terms. And there might be many, many more that are behind the average user's home firewall. And so that offers a layer of protection. It might be short-lived because really what's going to happen is a lot of people will get infected with malware, home users, and that malware might be used as a foothold on the user's PC to attack other IoT devices that are in the household. So it's a very complicated situation that's going on here. So these particular devices, for those that ask the question, how do we secure these devices? Sure, keep them behind the firewall, but you also have to make really, really sure that you don't leave the default password set.
Right.
Because that was the main issue in how these devices got hacked. It's using default passwords.
Well, Casey asks, how can I tell if any of my devices were part of the attack, and how can I protect them in the future, which is something we've already touched on. But Alina Salyuk, is it at all obvious to the device owner that it's being used in a malicious attack?
That is one of the trickiest elements here. It sounds really weird to think that your devices in your home are, you know, participating in a major cyber attack while you're, you know, hanging out. But it's actually pretty much impossible to tell if your device is compromised in this kind of way. And I really want to reiterate Jeremiah's point about default passwords. The code that he spoke about earlier that was released on the internet earlier was, in fact, the kind of code that sort of scrapes the internet for devices that are connected using factory default passwords. And when you think about it, when you buy, let's go back to baby monitors, but webcams, routers, or that thermostat or DVR, which is another type of device involved in this attack, how often do you really go out of your way to change the password? It's very easy to just click through and accept whatever is default filled out, all the forms. You don't want to worry about it. Well, now is the time to start worrying about it. Really, this is one very simple step to get that other layer of protection, change those default passwords. It's not possible or easy in some cases. Another question is whether people do enough software updates, which are also not always easy or available. But you really need to start thinking about updating the software as often as possible, making sure that your passwords are long, complex, and are changed from whatever the default came from the factory.
Well, Frank in Mill Valley has a question about passwords. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I work in this area as a lawyer, and what I've been hearing from the manufacturers is a lot of these simpler devices, unlike the TV or, you know, the more complex stuff, don't even have the ability for the user to change a password. That it's that open. Is that your experience? Or, in fact, do all these little tiny devices have a way to log in and change the the factory setting.
Great point, Frank. Jeremiah Grossman?
Most of these devices do have a way to change passwords or even little instructions hidden in the manual for how you change them. But it would not surprise me in the least if certain devices make it hard, if not impossible, to change the password. In the case of this botnet, the malware actually removed the user's ability to change the password. But one thing I'd also like to point out is that it can't only be the user's responsibility to secure these devices. The manufacturers must be held accountable for these things. They are shipping, you know, devices that are very much insecure, that are very much, you know, not in keeping with industry best practices, and they're not suffering any liability here.
But
something has to be done about that.
What is the government doing to make manufacturers more liable? And if, as many people say, government will be slow anyway, right? It will take a while for it to actually figure out a way to legislate this. What are industry trade groups doing to try to address this? Alina Sell, you touched on this, that there's some conversations there, but it doesn't seem like there's a lot that's come out of them.
I think we haven't seen very kind of tangible and hefty responses to these kind of criticisms, even though these criticisms have been around for quite a while. We are seeing now stepped up pressure from lawmakers today. A group of lawmakers who are focused on intelligence and cybersecurity are reaching out to the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Department of Homeland Security to talk about exactly that. What can the government do to really step up their pressure on manufacturers to produce better security? The big, I think, push will be on the business community itself to demand from their partners and from their contractors and from their suppliers to improve the security of the devices that are being shipped. There will, you know, in this particular instance, there were two manufacturers who were involved. They're both Chinese makers of webcams, I believe. And both of them are now recalling those devices, or are at least talking about recalling the devices and pushing out updates to their consumers. But of course, the tricky part is, how do you track down these consumers? In many cases, these kind of providers of these devices, they're either overseas, like in this case in China, or even locally, you don't know who your consumers are,
right.
If you're not operating through a contract.
And Jeremiah Grossman, we have just seconds left, but are there companies that are already building in these protections, regardless of the fact that it's not regulated?
Some are, but most are not, because there isn't a necessary market pressure to do so. IoT devices are sold as lowest common denominator, the cheapest that you can make it, so consumers will buy it. And so the manufacturers are incentivized economically to not put security in, because doing so costs more money. And that's really all you have left in the market, is the least secure devices. So that's why you cannot expect the industry in this case to
step up.
To police itself. We're going to need assistance.
Well, Jeremiah Grossman, Chief of Security Strategy at Sentinel One, thank you. And thanks also to Alina Selyuk, host of NPR's All Tech Considered blog. I guess the two takeaways are, change your passwords and update your software, if anything, if the industry is not going to step up. Up next, we discuss the American Academy of Pediatrics' new guidelines on screen time. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Stay with us.